Hello, Top 100 Podcasters. We're pleased to introduce the first Top 100 Project Contest for our listeners. We get lots of great feedback from you guys all the time, and we're asking you to share that feedback with the world via iTunes. So, anyone who writes a review for the Top 100 Project on iTunes by March 20th will have their name entered in a draw. On our March 23rd episode, Taxi Driver, we will pull a name, and that lucky winner will get to determine the subject of our very first crowdsourced episode of the Not 100 Project.
Democracy!
That means that our winner can pick any movie they like, and Ryan and I will make that movie the subject of a podcast.
Excluding pornography. No pornography.
Some suggestions we've received from viewers so far have included Star Trek, First Contact, and Super Troopers.
Okay, maybe pornography. It's possible.
It could be anything, people. Any movie that is not on the AFI Top 100 lists. What movie would you pick? Write a review for us and you may get to hear it. No preference will be given to particularly positive reviews. We welcome your honest opinion.
Spark plug coffee. Freshly ground and delicious. Custom roasted just for you. Front door delivery in Canada. If you want some, and you know you do, go to sparkplug.coffee.
You heard the man. It is time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in with Spark Plug Coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Buongiorno, fans of classic cinema, and grazie for listening to the Top 100 Project, where we glance back at the 123 motion pictures on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American movies. Spoiler alert, we will thoroughly discuss everything in this film. I am Ryan Ellis with my fellow crime boss who lives on a lakeshore in Nevada, my wife Bev.
That's me.
The coming attractions trivia for this week's film, The Godfather Part 2. Excluding the Godfather films, how many AFI movies released in the 1970s inspired sequels?
I have six.
You're almost there, but what do you got?
Okay, French Connection.
Correct.
American Graffiti.
Correct.
Chinatown.
Correct.
Jaws.
Yes.
Rocky.
Mm-hmm.
Star Wars.
You missed the very first one.
Which was?
The Last Picture Show.
There was a sequel to Last...
We talked
about
it.
Oh my god, I forgot.
Texasville.
I made a joke about it on last week's podcast too because I had so completely forgotten that they made a sequel to that. Oh my gosh.
Well, still pretty well done. So eight movies. I did exclude The Godfather from this. Of the 22.
Technically nine movies because The Godfather 2 also had a sequel.
That's why I excluded it. I thought this gets all confusing because they both inspired sequels. Speaking. But yeah, more than a third of the movies from this decade got more movies made. And that's not surprising because this decade is known for a lot of things. One of them is commercial success. Bit of a sidebar though, before we get into the body of this podcast, and not even Bev knows I'm about to bring this up. Today, I watched Tokyo Story.
I did not know that.
The reason I bring this up is because that movie was number one in the director's category of the Sight and Sound poll. We've talked about that a fair amount. That was the 2012 poll, and it was number three for the critics. Very highly ranked. I'd never seen it. You had.
Yeah.
I thought it was a good film. I don't think it's worthy of being number one by any means.
Yeah.
But definitely a very strong meditation on death, getting older, family, mm-hmm. disappointment, and just getting by. The movie is very ordinarily done. That's Ozu for you. He didn't move the camera at all. The opposite of Scorsese. There's a name we're going to talk about in this podcast, incidentally. The movie's very good, but I was surprised people loved it as much as they did, unless you're going by the logic that film critics are older people who maybe can relate to this movie better than the average person.
Definitely you would appeal to somebody who's older and looking back at their life and probably looking at their kids in a rather cynical, misanthropic way. You know, sometimes your kids just don't grow up the way you expect them to, or things just don't turn out the way you expect them to.
Here's another connection. You and I just happened to watch Love is Strange not long ago, the movie that came out in 2014, Alfred Molina and John Lithgow, about two gay men who get married after many decades together, and then right away one of them loses his job, and they are out of their apartment in New York, and they have to live with friends and family, and they're split apart for most of the movie. Those two movies to me are actually connected. Love is Strange and Tokyo Story have very big similarities, I felt like they did anyway.
Small movies exploring big ideas that affect every single one of us. But and there's a real pragmatism or honesty about them that can sometimes make you very uncomfortable.
I think what it was for me, though, is that both movies, it's Lithgow and Love is Strange, and it's the parents, the grandparents, really, the older couple, in Tokyo Story. No one wants to say it, but they're not really wanted.
I couldn't say it was the most entertaining film I ever saw, but I've never stopped thinking about it since I saw it.
And the reason I bring it up is because, A, I just saw it the day we recorded this podcast, and B, because the movie that inspired the movie we're about to talk about was number 3 on the list, then number 2, and if they ever do another list, it might very well be number 1. So what a comparison that is. The Sight and Sound poll that's done every 10 years, and the AFI list that has not been done in quite a long time. They haven't done a new list in quite a few years. All right, moving on. So, the Top 100 Project's 88th motion picture, The Godfather Part 2, was 32nd on both of AFI's Top 100 lists between Annie Hall and High Noon in 98, then betwixt The Maltese Falcon and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in 2007. Paramount Pictures gave Part 2 a premiere in New York City on December 12, 1974, then released it in time for Christmas on December 20th. This motion picture raked in mucho bucks, although it wasn't as successful as Part 1. Not many movies were back then. Bev will describe The Godfather Part 2 for you now with the skinny.
The Corleone exploits continue after the tumultuous events of the first film. Al Pacino's Michael has moved his crime enterprise to Nevada in an attempt to go legit. But his wife Kay, played by Diane Keaton, struggles mightily with the type of empire Michael and his father have built. All this is interwoven with flashbacks of Robert De Niro as the young Vito rising to power in New York in the early 20th century.
Or in a nutshell, gambling magnate spoils brother's fishing trip.
Oh, man.
That's the name of the character we didn't mention in that skinny a minute ago. My favorite character in the whole movie, actually, Fredo.
Yeah, spoiler, he doesn't catch a big one.
His Hail Marys win him nothing. We're going to talk a lot about Fredo on the podcast. Before we get to him, let's talk about the big picture of this film. 99% of critics, 67 fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, only one rotten, 97% of audiences. Those reviews are pretty much right in line with the first Godfather, which actually had 100% of critics. Incidentally, Godfather Part 3, 67% of critics and 78% of audiences. And box office-wise, the movie was 6th at the 1974 U.S. box office. Blazing Saddles was far and away number 1, and last week's film Chinatown wasn't even in the top 10. But all that aside, what does Bev think of The Godfather Part 2, one of the longest films we've seen on the entire project so far?
I said this about Chinatown, too. I like this movie better every time I see it. I think there's some room to criticize it. The Vito storyline is a little treacly and forgiving, and the plot is distractingly hard to follow, but every scene is just so beautiful and brimming with depth and meaning. It truly is a masterpiece. Shame about the third one.
What makes Vito's storyline treacly?
It has always bothered me just how lightly the movie treats the fact that he's a murderer, a burglar, a criminal. Yes, okay. He's a family man. Yeah, he doesn't cheat on his wife. He robs people.
And kills two crime bosses.
He kills two crime bosses.
As much as they may deserve it, he does murder them in cold blood.
And we know later in the film he's responsible for some less justified murders, to put it lightly. And he puts his whole family at tremendous risk when he goes to Italy just to kill that old mob boss. He's ballsy, but I think the movie treats it with a really forgiving light. Now, mind you, that's all kind of made null and void by the fact that Vito's actions lead to 4 miserable children, 4 terrible outcomes for his children.
Well, hang on. I want to talk about the Don Ciccio murder, the guy who kills all of his family. First trivia question I can ask you. What is Vito's father's full name?
Antonio Andolini?
Andolini.
I was right. Very close.
So all of Vito's family is murdered before he even gets to America.
When he's 9 years old.
And that's an interesting contrast, by the way. Vito flees to America to avoid death, and Michael in the first movie flees from America to avoid death.
Oh yeah, that's so true.
One going from Italy, one going to Italy. But why he goes over there as a grown man to kill the old mob boss who can't even see or hear him anyway at this point. Also, maybe that's paralleled in Hyman Roth's story, who's been dying of the same heart attack for many years. Yeah. It's also a business opportunity. Don Tomasino talks about our partner from America, meaning the olive oil thing. Because don't forget, that is a front, but they actually are doing olive oil importing and exporting. So maybe Don Ciccio over in Italy is some kind of interferer with that, or he's taken a cut he didn't deserve. So as these people like to say all the time, just business, which we know in the Corleone family is not true at all. That's often business, but often it's not.
It's often vendetta.
Vendetta, yes. But that's maybe one of the reasons why he kills him. So is he risking his family in that sense? Well, in his mind, he's opening up a business opportunity.
I think in his mind is strictly vengeance.
Well, that's definitely
that's like
a huge part of it.
Closure for him. That's closure of his story.
Oh, I think that's a big part of it. I think it's also, though, that he's doing this because he's got to try to make business better for the family. Okay, well, there you go. There's the other murder he commits in this movie. And Robert Towne, who says on the 100 Years, 100 Movies show that we've talked about 100 times on this podcast, his favorite piece of screenwriting is in this movie when Vito's scaling the rooftops, stalking Finucci, and then eventually kills him because he's both providing for his son and he's destroying his son.
Way far in the future,
Sons and daughter. Yeah. Specifically, I think Towne's talking about Michael, not even Sonny, who is the oldest son. Not even Fredo, who's the second oldest son, but Michael because he becomes the mob boss later on. That's also about business. And also about vengeance to an extent. Finucci didn't murder anybody in Vito's family. He didn't do anything that was all that bad by him. He did take his job away, though, whether he really meant to or not.
And he was obviously really corrupt. I mean, they're all corrupt. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. But his level of corruption was just... He was a bully, and he was mean, and he was greedy. And the insinuation is that Vito was a far more benevolent leader when he was mafia boss. Mm-hmm. He murdered people for the right reasons. And he took money from all those shopkeepers, but he was reasonable about it, I suppose we're supposed to believe. Everybody seems properly afraid of him, though. We never learn how come the landlord is so terrified of him.
Well, no one takes Vito seriously until he commits murder in cold blood of Finucci. He's more of a joke. He's more of an afterthought. He's just this punk. Finucci thinks of him that way right to the very end.
Yeah.
What have you got there? The guy's got a gun wrapped up in a towel. Now, who would know that he's going to do that? But he probably should be a little more suspicious about this guy.
It's a great touch, though. Yeah. He thinks so little of him that he doesn't feel remotely threatened or worried.
Yeah, even though he's stalking him in a dark hallway.
Meanwhile, when we see Vito as an older man, he always has somebody with him. He always has a bodyguard, be they inept or not.
And a line he has in that movie, Brando says it, and then they would fear you, which is really what it's more about. Respect is important, but it's more about fear. And that landlord you talked about, the slumlord, first he sloughs Vito off, and then it's all about not respecting Vito so much as being terrified of him.
Yeah, so much so that not only does he acquiesce to his demands, but then he lowers her rent and backs out amusingly, and they're laughing at him, but that man is terrified of him.
And Vito is really not being fair in that scene, actually. If it had just been things were the way they were, then okay, I guess that's fair. But he's actually trying to screw the guy over.
Yeah.
We talked about critics a few minutes ago and what they thought of the film. Not everybody did love it, though. Andrew Sarris, Vincent Canby, and even Roger Ebert in his review in 1974 did not love the movie. Ebert liked it. The other two did not. Those are reputable names. They thought the movie wasn't all that great, though. I guess they're not Rotten Tomatoes critics because, as I said, only one rotten review on there. On the other hand, Sidney Lumet, a filmmaker, is on the AFI show saying, "I'm angry with Francis Ford Coppola because he made two of my five favorite American movies," referring to the two Godfather pictures. I'd like to know his other three favorite films are. Sarris, Canby, Ebert, and Lumet aside, one of our longtime listeners, oftentimes commenters, Grant, did not like the first movie much at all. I won't speak for him about this film, but let me take some excerpts from him. We're going to open up the mailbag. We haven't done this in a little while. He's not a big fan of the actors in general. He thinks Brando's being sloppy and cartoonish. He didn't think Pacino was doing anything. It's lifeless. Is this guy even awake? He thinks Duvall is fine, but he's just playing Duvall. He liked Khan the most. He acknowledges the movie's very good looking, but as far as the tension goes, and the movie was, I think, 11th. The first one was on the throws list. But he says the tension goes away pretty quickly, even in the scene where Michael commits murder of Sollozzo and McCluskey. And the last two things he says are it's the most overrated anything in the history of all pop culture. And Godfather fanatics have scolded me for saying this before, but there is absolutely nothing in this film that Goodfellas doesn't do much more involvingly and entertainingly. But at least it's better than Scarface. Now again, he's talking about the first movie.
You know, I'll say Goodfellas, I would put that movie in before Godfather any day of the week. Or Godfather Part 2. Goodfellas is a way funner movie.
Oh,
it's just way more kinetic, energetic, and fun. Easier to follow and less cerebral, but still just as deep. And I agree with you, Grant. Scarface is not a good movie. I don't know why anybody likes that movie. What the big deal
is. But there are
is.
Big connections to The Godfather. It's more of a blue-collar version or black-collar version.
Yeah,
brown-collar version.
Immigrant criminal
because Goodfellas,
story.
Goodfellas is truly the blue-collar version of The Godfather movies.
Oh, talk about overrated, though. Anyways, I'll answer the angry letters about that one later.
The Goodfellas connections will continue, though, because it was second in the mobster category of the top 100 genres.
After Godfather.
Godfather 1 was the first. Godfather 2 was third. So Sam
is
right in there. And also, you know who could have been the director of this film when they first bandied about making a sequel?
Scorsese.
Martin Scorsese. Yeah. When Coppola was asked who he thought should direct it, he just wanted to produce and write with Mario Puzo again. They wrote the first film together. Who should direct this movie? Francis? Martin Scorsese, over my dead body. That may have been Robert Evans, who Coppola had such problems with in the first film. And then he tried to ban him from this movie. According to him, Evans had no involvement in Godfather Part 2, and it was a much more smooth production. Yeah. That's what Coppola said for years.
Well, they wanted Coppola back. He wanted to back off and give it to somebody else. And in order to convince him, they gave him $1 million, 13% of the box office take, which is enormous. It wound up being a tremendous amount of money. And complete artistic control. That was the deal, and that was the honey that sweetened the pot and got him to do it.
Now, it wouldn't have been interesting, though, if it had been Scorsese, because he was just coming up with Mean Streets.
Yeah.
I was recently reading that Scorsese's movies, according to him, are all about brothers. Not every movie has been, but a lot of them have been. Raging Bull, Goodfellas, either literal brothers or metaphorical brothers.
Yeah.
This movie, as much as any movie we have covered or will cover, is about brothers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And interestingly, too, the head of the mob family is a black sheep, who's hated by two of his siblings. They say so in this film. Connie at one point doesn't like him, then she kowtows to him because she has to, because he's the guy running the whole thing, so she ends up being a big part of his life. We barely see Talia Shire until the last maybe 30 minutes of the whole film, which is also true of Diane Keaton. Mm. We talked about in the first movie, those two actresses are in three movies, all won Best Picture, three AFI films, the two Godfathers for each of them, Rocky for Talia Shire, Annie Hall for Diane Keaton. But neither actress is in this movie very much until towards the end, when Talia Shire is coming back into Michael's life, and Kay is leaving his life.
Yeah, they don't have a lot of screen time, but they really do a lot with that screen time. Both of those actresses kill it. I love the scene early with Telly Shire with her boyfriend when she's trying to get Michael to give her blessing, give her money, really, to go marry her boyfriend and carry on her life of rebellion, leaving her children behind. And Diane Keaton is incredible. That moment when she makes up her mind to tell Michael about the abortion, you see so much go on in her face. And when he shuts the door in her face for the second time in this series, he shuts the door separating her from her children, and the agony on her face. Really beautiful scenes, really well done.
Well timed, too, because she breaks down, her face crumples right as the door's almost past where her face is. I'm sure that took more than one take. It's really well done by the technical people involved, Pacino closing the door, and then her crying at the exact right moment. But I said brothers. Hagen at one point says in the film he always wanted to be thought of as an actual brother. And he always was a brother of sorts with these guys, but not really. Fredo, the actual brother, and the other one who hated Michael at one point, and even says so in the movie. Why don't we spend time like this before? This is the most underrated performance maybe in movie history.
He carries this movie. He is the heart of this movie.
John Cazale also had an incredible resume in the 70s. And we talked about it on the first Godfather film. We talked about it when we did Dog Day Afternoon, a 900 Project movie quite a few months ago. He was in five movies. The Godfather films, The Deer Hunter, Dog Day Afternoon, and The Conversation. Maybe that's the one that stands out. It's a good film, but not quite as legendary as the other ones. I've watched that scene on YouTube so many times, a few times since we saw the movie, in the solarium, where he's sitting in that chair, Michael standing up. There's hundreds of layers in that scene. We talked about it on Giant months and months and months ago, how Rock Hudson has a scene where he's having a battle with Dennis Hopper, who plays his son. And Hudson's a tall, intimidating man. Hopper's not particularly big, and he's also playing the son. Hopper's standing, he's mad. Hudson gets a little mad, but for the most part stays seated. I don't know if there's any connection. I don't know if that was what Coppola's direction to Cazale was. But Cazale is the one who's angry. Never gets out of that chair. He's so emasculated in that moment.
And it's a lean-back chair, too. Yeah. He's not just sitting down. He's sitting back. He's almost lying down. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't make a move because he wouldn't make a move. He knows, Fredo knows, that he would have made a terrible godfather and he should have been passed over. But Michael, all he had to do was baby his ego a little more. Fredo would have required nothing more than a little bit of attention. He didn't even need jobs to do. He just needed to be part of his life and part of the family and to have some kind of closeness with him. I do believe that what Fredo really needed more than anything else was for Michael to just treat him like they were family, like he was his brother. And he was lonely and he felt rejected personally, and that's why he lashed out. Well, but not lashed out, it's just why he was vulnerable to all these bad forces. You see it with his wife, his embarrassing trophy wife who doesn't listen to him, and he has to get other people to beat her up for him when she misbehaves, and she's misbehaving very badly, embarrassing him. And it made him susceptible to Hyman Roth and Hyman Roth's people who talked him into going along with this plot that ultimately wound up in an assassination attempt.
Which he claims he didn't know about, but he had to know it was at least a possibility. And in any case, he's betraying his own
brother.
He's
betrayed the family.
Well, let's stay with that solarium scene for a minute, because the part about that scene that kills me is you're watching two people who are criminals. One of especially, who belongs in jail many times over, that being Michael. But Fredo does too, by any normal standards of society. But when you watch it through the eyes of two brothers in this broken relationship, that even when you first see the movie, you have to know it's not going to be solved. But he watched it through the lens of two brothers. That's the way Pop wanted it. Ain't the way I wanted it! And that blind rage, it almost made me cry when I watched it on YouTube not long ago, because I watched it through those eyes, And Fredo in the first movie to me is so inconsequential. I guess he's supposed to be. But when we watched The Godfather about a month ago, I paid more attention to him. And he is ignored by Vito. Yeah. Vito doesn't have very many scenes with anybody. As we said in that podcast, he has way more dialogue with Hagen than he has with anybody else. He doesn't even talk to Sonny all that much, and only with Michael at the very end of the movie, the last maybe half hour or so. But Fredo never gets to speak to his father, really, except for the assassination attempt when he tells him he's going to go buy oranges. Okay, Pop, that's pretty much the only dialogue he ever has with the guy in the movie. So this is one of those movies you have to read between the lines a lot of, and that's one of the great scenes. To me, it may be top 10 great scenes in the history of movies. It's so easy to pick 150 of your favorite scenes. If it's not my favorite, it's certainly somewhere in the top 10. That is a brilliant scene.
And his performance is so earnest and raw and real. Like, it feels so authentic. And Grant, in his comment, complained about Pacino just seeming catatonic, Brando seeming a little cartoonish. I tend to kind of agree that those performances overrated, maybe just because it's one of those critical praises that have snowballed over the years until people just get really hyperbolic about it. But it is a shame watching these movies and seeing that Cazale was overlooked. Maybe because he died young, so he never got to continue his career like these other actors and become really legendary. He would have certainly been a legendary Hollywood actor had he not passed away of cancer right after The Deer Hunter.
During The Deer Hunter,
which is a shame. We lost a really great actor, but he's overlooked in this film.
Three actors were nominated for Best Supporting Actor. Three actors were nominated for the first film, Best Supporting Actor. The first time nobody won. It was Joel Grey and Cabaret. And this time, somebody did win. It was Robert De Niro, who plays young Vito, Michael Vigazzo, who plays Frankie Pentangeli, and Lee Strasberg playing Hyman Roth is the third nomination. All those guys are fantastic. You could have had all five actors be from this movie very easily in the supporting category. But Cazale should have been definitely one of those three five or something.
Yeah, definitely. You just mentioned Lee Strasberg. His performance also was a real standout for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, you pay close attention because he is the iconic Lee Strasberg. He wrote the book on method acting.
Pacino's mentor.
He's Pacino's mentor, along with lots of other actors like James Dean.
He's the method acting guy, or at least one of them.
And so I paid really close attention to his performance for that reason. I love just the little physical affects when Pacino first meets him and he's sitting in a room. He doesn't stand up. He doesn't even sit up. He has his leg kind of splayed over the chair in this really casual manner that on one hand is inviting. Oh, it's you and me. I don't have to put on airs. But on the other hand is also disrespectful. And knowing Michael the way we do, he's going to interpret this the way it's probably at least subconsciously meant to be interpreted. There's so many great subtle gestures in his performance, and he's such a full character and an interesting character. I would love to know more about Hyman Roth and what is behind this man who's worth $400 million but lives in like a bungalow in a subdivision, a house that you and I could afford.
He's based on Meyer Lansky, the actual gangster, just like Bugsy Siegel is who Alex Rocco is effectively playing in the first movie. And that's the one time you see the real mean bastard come out of him is when he talks about how Mo Green was killed. I didn't say anything. I knew it was business, but he is saying, I know you killed this guy and I'm going to get you back for it without actually saying that. How does Michael know who tried to kill him? When does he know what he knows? And does he really know anything? Is he just guessing that Hyman was behind it all when he says he knows early on? He accuses him and he accuses Frankie Pentangeli. Before we get into that sidebar, let me briefly talk about Michael Vigazzo, who plays Pentangeli. What a shame that Richard Castellano, who played Clemenza in the first film, wanted too much from Coppola. He apparently wanted to write his own dialogue, and he wanted an awful lot of money to play what is a very effective, but a supporting character. But it should have been him. Yeah. Frankie Pentangeli, we can imagine, was an important lieutenant in the many years intervening between the first movie and the second, and even before the first movie's events take place. But if it's Clemenza, you got that great continuity where Tessio, at the end of the first movie, is about to sell them out. And as he says, it's just business. But he gets whacked. Clemenza should have been the one who was supposed to inform on them, but doesn't get a chance to do it because his own brother, again, brothers, intimidates him into not saying anything, and he ends up killing himself. It's unfortunate that they had to lose that. They also lost Brando because he didn't want to come back for the sequel because he was mad that Paramount treated him the way they did in the first movie with both the money and the fact they didn't respect him enough or something. I don't know.
The pre-production for this film is filled with stories of people with enormous egos making crazy, unreasonable demands. I want to write every piece of my own dialogue.
What for supporting character. For it's supporting not like character. It's Michael.
Yeah. Who are you? Brando just absolutely refusing to come back. James Caan got the same salary to come back for that one scene. He spent, I think, one day on set, and he got paid the same for that as he did for the entire first movie.
Not a prima donna action going on there.
Yeah, seriously.
Okay. But Frankie Pentangeli is the one who supposedly sold them out, or was Hyman Roth? And you and I talked about this when the movie was over. How did Michael know what he knew when he knew it?
How was he playing them against each other? I mean, who even made the assassination attempt on Pantangeli? Was it Roth?
I think Roth tried to kill Michael, and I think Roth tried to kill Pantangeli. But as you pointed out during the movie, there's like a lot of failed assassination attempts in this film.
Oh, they bungle everything.
The one that succeeds at the end is when Neri has Fredo dead to rights, point blank, in a boat.
Yeah.
It's one of the only ones that does succeed. There's a lot of failures. So without being certain, I would say that Roth is behind all of it because he is trying to get both revenge for Mo Green and also it is just business, as these people like to say so often.
I kind of get how Michael figured out that Fredo was the leak, the one that turned on him, but I do not get how he figured out that it was Roth.
Okay, let's get past that because you just brought up my favorite part of the movie other than the Fredo stuff. Okay, maybe my favorite part of the movie anyway, including the Fredo stuff, and it's Al Pacino, who is so great in this film. This was the year... And there have been many years like this, but a year of incredibly great performances by male actors in the Oscar category. The five nominees that year didn't even include Gene Hackman in the conversation, which you should have. But the nominees were Pacino for this, Nicholson for Chinatown, Dustin Hoffman for Lenny, Albert Finney for Murder on the Orient Express, and the one who won, Art Carney, in a movie about a cat, Harry and Tonto or something.
Really?
He's the guy that won. I don't really know why. I love Nicholson, love Hoffman, love Finney. Pacino is the best thing in this movie. He's the best thing of any actor that year. Particularly for two moments. You just said a minute ago, he figures out that Fredo is the one who betrayed him. Because earlier Fredo says he doesn't know who Johnny Ola is. And who plays him? Dominic Chianese, Uncle Junior in The Sopranos.
Oh, yeah.
But then Fredo mentions that when they're in that club, Johnny Ola told me about it. The look on Michael's face, the eyes. He is gut shot. I've talked about this with friends for many years. I think that is the greatest moment, along with one other one in this movie, that Pacino's ever had in any movie. This legendary actor, shticky cartoon for so long. The guy dies, and does this guy deserve to be tortured for the things he does? Yes. But again, we've said this in the first movie. In their world, forgetting the fact that he's a vile criminal, you feel bad for this person who realizes my brother sold me out? It kills me. The moment where he kisses Fredo and says, I know it was you, you broke my heart. That's the moment that people always quote, but to me, it's the look on his face that says, he did this?
Yeah, poor Michael. Although, poor Michael, who's a bad person and does bad things, but this whole movie is just him suffering. People betraying him and him becoming more and more alienated from the world and from family, from human interaction and relations. Fredo, and there's also Kay. Mm-hmm. When Kay tells him that she had an abortion and his heart is just broken. Because it's not even just that the child is lost, which he's obviously very upset about, mm-hmm. and rightfully so, but it's also that she did this thing, and she says it herself. She knew he could never forgive her, and she did it in a way for that reason.
And that would end the marriage.
Yeah, she wanted out that bad.
In a movie about killers, even Kay becomes a killer by aborting the baby. Yeah. I'm not making a judgment call on her for that, but that's what she is.
Especially in his mind, certainly.
Oh, definitely in his mind, yeah, and his Catholic upbringing, all that stuff. And that's the other moment with the eyes. With Fredo, it's shock. With her, it's rage. It was an abortion, Michael. This must all end. Before he slaps her, the look on his face, wow. I mean, Pacino can do rage better than almost anybody I've ever seen.
So this movie is really the devolution of Michael. Mm-hmm. His story is the devolution. It's him becoming less and less human as all these things are happening to him. Even though he's successful in the business sense, but in the personal sense, at the end of the film, you are sure that he will never recover from this. His fate is sealed to just be an unhappy person. And you contrast this with the juxtaposition of Vito's story, where Vito is rising to power. Vito is close with his family. Everything Vito does makes him happier and improves his life and the lives of everybody around him. Yet, Vito's actions are directly leading to Michael's misery down the road.
And that's the part that Ebert had a problem with. He didn't like the flashback structure. His point of view was that could be a whole separate movie and that would be interesting enough, but it should just be about Michael. The other point of view on that is that they made a sequential movie back in the 70s. Yeah. There's something on one of the DVDs, I remember watching this, where Coppola, in the mid-70s, did a re-edit. And I think that defeats the purpose of the whole damn series. I don't want to see it sequentially. This movie was made with the flashback structure. There's an awful lot of scenes where you see Michael and Vito on the same screen at the same time in a very slow dissolve.
Yes.
And sometimes their heads are in the exact same place on the screen. Take that away and that takes away so much of the power of those moments.
And those counter stories are the points, the illustration of the theme that even though Vito is succeeding in that very sepia-toned, happy past, his actions do have consequences.
As Robert Towne says, so effectively.
Yes.
If he'd found some honest job, he had the grocery store job and he lost it because of the mob boss. But if he found something else and just had a normal immigrant lifestyle, then he and his four kids and his wife might have been okay. Wouldn't have been rich, but they could have lived a normal life.
It is my opinion that Mario Puzo and Coppola were trying to say, had he kept that grocery store job, maybe left the guns alone and not become partners with these criminals, those four children, they may not be rich. They may not have the opportunities those kids did ultimately have, but they would be happier.
Like, as middle-aged people,
yeah.
Two of them are essentially alone. They pretty much only have each other. That's Michael and Connie, and the other two are dead by violent means. So who is the one who corrupts Vito, or helps corrupt Vito at least? And it's Clemenza. What does Clemenza give him to hide?
Guns.
A bag full of guns.
Yep.
And even at that moment, he's not actually going to do anything with them. He just does what his neighbor wants him to do. I love that moment, too. They're not even feet. They're 8 foot away from each other with those two windows from different apartments. New York. I love New York. That is one crowded city and a lot of parts of the city. But anyway, something you point out during the movie, though, is that we do have the Jesus-esque missing years for Vito. He goes from being a nine-year-old with smallpox in 1901 in Ellis Island. Ellis Island! Where the Statue of Liberty is. Yeah. And then suddenly he's a grown man, I guess in his mid-20s, as the grocery store clerk. What happened to those missing Jesus years? Took him in?
The years I want an explanation for is how he goes from being the guy who killed the mobster to surviving whatever vengeance people would have wanted to take on him for that, and then becoming as powerful as he did. He had to do something to get that powerful in that time.
That's another avenue that this movie could have taken, I suppose, is how did he and Clemenza and Tessio, and whoever they got to work with him probably fairly quickly after he killed Finucci, how did they fend off Finucci's other people, his bosses or his underlings or his capo regimes?
Yeah.
It's a whole other movie, I guess.
Story didn't end in that hallway with that towel on fire. Great. Oh, I love that detail. Mm-hmm. The towel catches
and
on
also
fire.
Hidden with the sound because the fireworks going off outside.
Yeah. No convenient. I don't know how he timed it so perfectly, but he did.
Maybe got lucky. Maybe knew something was coming.
Yeah. Another victim of a shot to the face, too. Coppola does love shots to the face and the eye and the cheek.
Mm.
He likes people to see their assassin.
So that's Vito killing the big mob boss when he's a young man. We talk about Michael blowing an awful lot of people away, including have his own brother killed, when he's a middle-aged man. You've never seen Godfather Part 3. I'm going to spoil the movie. People
and
probably know
I tried
anyway.
To watch Godfather Part 3, but it's excruciating. I couldn't finish it. I watched the first hour.
It does have a strong ending, though, and I'm going to ruin the movie for those who haven't seen it. I think people who know this movie probably know the end of that one. Before I get to that, though, I said this to you when the second movie was over. Godfather 3 should have been about him and his son, because there's these underlying elements of Anthony becoming the new Michael. Michael says, he's fine. Kay says, he's not fine. That big fight scene. Well, Anthony's barely a part of the movie. What is he not fine about? And I guess maybe the idea is that he's pulling away from his mother.
There's foreshadowing, too, with the toy car that's left out in the snow, a la Rosebud.
Citizen Kane, yeah, that's right. So then that would have been a great way to play the third movie and then have Duvall be a part of it, because Hagen's always been in the family, then he's kicked out, then he's back in, then he's sort of not in again, and Michael always kind of push-pulls with him. He's always playing with Tom Hagen, who has always been loyal, as he even says in the movie. That's what the third movie should have been about. Now, unfortunately, Duvall wanted more money than they wanted to pay him, so he pulled out of doing that third movie. They had to rewrite it. But then they've got Andy Garcia playing Sonny's bastard son, who becomes the new mob boss. Okay, that's a different way to go than have it be Anthony, I suppose. Nothing wrong with that. But that seems to be the logical payoff to this. Okay, so the way the third movie ends, and here's the spoiler, and everyone knows so famously that Sofia Coppola is bad in Part 3, but at the end, she's accidentally murdered on what was supposed to have been a hit on Michael. He is shot, but he doesn't die. And Pacino plays that grief very well. They talk about how they had to cut out the beginning of his scream of sorrow because it was just too agonizing. And it was also an artistic statement. The very end of that movie is him alone, many years later. I think it's supposed to be the mid-90s or something. He's an old man. He's sitting in a chair. It looks like it's Italy. Falls over and dies face down in the dirt. And there's a nice comparison to Vito because he dies also in the dirt in the first movie. Now, he's also with Anthony. He seems to be a pretty happy man. He's retired. I'm sure that was a very deliberate connection, but both of these guys live through all the stuff they've created to be fairly old guys, more so Michael than Vito, and then get to die a peaceful death, but in the case of Michael, all alone. How fitting is that?
I guess the big difference between Vito and Michael, maybe that sealed their fate and made their characters, is Vito really grew up without a family at all. It's all about family, but he was orphaned at 9. Mm-hmm. He's taken care of by people in the neighborhood, but these aren't people that we see later on in his adulthood, right? That's right. So we know that his family is the family that he made, and he values them tremendously. And he grew up really poor, smallpox, by himself in New York City. And Michael grew up filthy rich. All those kids grew up rich. And all four of them were kind of spoiled. I mean, Connie and Fredo, that's easy. They were obviously pretty spoiled. And Yeah, Sonny was a hothead who just seemed to get his way all the time. Wasn't a good family man, was clearly not good to his wife. And Michael tried to be like his father. He tried to be like Vito, but he was just play-acting it. He didn't feel it the way Vito did. He never cheated on Kay that we saw, and he definitely talked and acted like a man who loved his kids. But you know, the truth behind it has more to do with his pride. Which is his fatal flaw, many point out.
And Hagen asked him, do you want to kill everybody? Not everybody, just my enemies. Well, then, who's your enemies? Now, there's another comparison. This movie was released in 1974, and Nixon was just recently taken out of power because he'd resigned in August of that year. But the movie was made when he was still the president.
Yeah, a very smart man who was also paranoid, like Michael.
And who had an enemies list.
Yeah.
And the comparison I would also make is that there's a lot of meetings in this movie where people talk about politics, they talk about murder, they talk about money. I don't think there's much doubt that Nixon had similar types of meetings with people who were elected officials or people he appointed when he was an elected official, the highest elected official in the entire land.
Perhaps he's lucky he didn't have a thing for prostitutes. Which I have to point out, this crazy thing they kind of gloss over in the movie is that they've upgraded from killing horses to killing people. To killing women.
And Hagen's involved in both of them.
Yeah, they really gloss over the fact that they murdered, and in their attempts to get legit. But in order for that to happen, we have to have this politician wrapped around our finger. We could just pay him what he wants, but why would we pay him a couple hundred thousand dollars when we can murder an innocent woman and pin it on him?
And here's part of the more corrupt part of this whole family. Michael gives full control to Hagen when he goes off to deal with Hyman Roth and do some other business stuff. And that's when that scene happens.
Yeah.
So Hagen's the one who would have ordered the hit, and we see Neary in the bathroom, who obviously did the actual killing of this prostitute. So Michael could claim plausible deniability, but he's still effectively in charge of the family, and he would have done something like that. He probably did do things like that we didn't see in the many years between the first movie and the second movie, and he's done way worse than that anyway. I'm sure there's no doubt that Coppola and Puzo knew exactly what they were doing there, that Hagen, who for the most part seems like a pretty moral guy in their world, is still pretty immoral by any other standards.
Yeah.
And he's the one in charge, and yet Michael's still fully in charge of the family, in effect. So you get this whole sort of, well, I didn't do that. Like you said with the horse thing in the first film, who actually killed the horse? Who actually said to kill the horse? And that's something else in this movie with all the testifying.
Yeah.
The many buffers, the layers. And who's the first guy? Who is the first guy that testifies against Michael at the Senate hearings?
It's the guy, the one whose name is very Italian sounding.
Willie Chichi. Yes,
Chichi, of course.
This guy, Joe Spinell, was in four AFI movies. Al Pacino was only in the two. We've covered him. He's done. But Joe Spinell is in the two Godfather films in small roles as Willie Chichi. He's in Rocky and he's in Taxi Driver. Not a bad resume for that guy. So here we are talking about politics. We're talking so much about the senator and the hearings. And by the way, one of those senators is Roger Corman, legendary producer and director of B-films. He's an actor in two AFI films. He's in more movies than a lot of bona fide actors like Charlton Heston and Spencer Tracy are, because he's also in Silence of the Lambs in a very small role. But getting back to politics, that's one of the things that Vito talks about in the first movie. Senator Corleone, Governor Corleone. He wanted Michael to be an actual politician, which as we certainly know now is not necessarily the most honorable thing either.
Well, Michael has that great conversation with Kay where she's like, oh, they don't have people killed. And he's like, you're being naive. That great little exchange that they have. Both these films, fundamental theme of it is power corrupts.
Okay.
And that would be true for a mob boss who just has less visibility of what they do by the public. It's more cloistered. But politicians certainly will be corrupted. That senator had choices about how to behave right from the beginning, from the way that he dealt with Michael, and he made corrupt choices.
Just like the president who had just resigned.
Yes.
Richard Nixon.
Michael wants to go legit, but he's not going to get any less selfish and greedy and cutthroat. Mm-hmm. And he talks about looking out for his family. It's all about family, and they definitely value looking after your family. But I love that they include that scene when he's in Cuba, and he's sitting in the car, and all those poor children come running up looking for a handout, and his assistant rolls his window up for him. And you see right there, like, he only cares about his family. That is what the cloistered thing does, too, is it puts you in this bubble where you only see how your actions affect
the people that you know. Do we not do that? Now.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I think Coppola's pointing out. He's pointing out about him, and it's true about the politicians.
Even real middle-class people in the world now.
Sure. Oh, my God. Yeah.
We live in the biggest city in this country, and we both have passed by many beggars and not given them money. So we can't pass too much judgment on that.
What about the window we roll up between ourselves and the rest of the world and the places that make our cell phones and our clothing. You're absolutely right, and that's part of the criticism.
And Cuba is where Michael finds out that Fredo betrayed him, as that leads into the Cuban Revolution, which would be, of course, headed up by Fidel Castro.
Mm-hmm. Which is the people rising up against corruption. Mm-hmm. You know, when they talk about why they like Cuba so much, they say, well, it's because they can buy and sell the president.
They're dividing it up. They have a cake where they're all cutting it up. Yeah. And that's not exactly a subtle metaphor.
Help yourselves to Cuba. These aren't even Cuban people who are separating Cuba. Coppola received a little bit of criticism for kind of incorporating those two storylines, but I think it's perfect because the point is that eventually, when this corruption gets bad enough, the people will turn on you. That was a successful revolution. Many decades later, that is still the structure that's in power in Cuba.
That's right. Obama has said they're going to open up relations finally. All right, so here's my question for you. We've talked about politics the last few minutes. Vito wanted Michael to have been a politician. How would Vito feel about the way Michael and the Corleones in general turned out?
His character being what it is, he would probably blame himself, which would be somewhat appropriate. He would blame himself for not raising Michael right and not raising Fredo and Connie right, and for getting them into this in the first place. I think he would see it for what it is. He made a wrong decision at one point.
I guess the question should have been stated this way, though. We talked at the end of the first movie about whether or not Vito actually knew that Michael was going to have all the mob bosses killed. Was he in on it? Because he's the one who says at that big mobster convention in the first movie, I will not be the one to break the peace we've made here today. Mm-hmm. If they let Michael come back and that's forgotten and everything is done with the Salazzo McCluskey thing in the past. But if Vito's involved in him betraying Barzini and Italia and all those guys at all, if he knew about it, then he lied directly. Although, as I think we said in that first podcast, he says something about how he swears in the lives of his grandchildren. But he can also claim somewhere in the eternity, well, I didn't know that Michael did. But you were involved in it, maybe. But we don't know he was. So that's the whole gray area.
I don't think he was. I think Michael waited till he was dead. Connie says as much. You waited until Dad was dead, and then you had Carlo killed.
And he also has to wait till his mother's dead to kill Fredo.
He knows his parents wouldn't approve of his actions, but his parents are indirectly responsible for his actions.
And his mother has more dialogue in the first scene she has with Connie, I think, than she had in the entire first movie, or really the rest of this movie.
Did you catch that in the flashbacks, there's a scene early on when Vito is discussing the burglary. They go into a room and he shuts the door so that his wife can't see. Just like the famous scene where Michael shuts the door on Kay at the end of the first film. The difference being that Mama Corleone, she understands her role. She understands what's expected of her, and she doesn't expect to be included in any
He's doing it more out of respect. I think he's doing it more of, you don't want to know these things.
I don't know. If you respect somebody, you would let them in on the fact that you are taking a risk like that. You're taking part in something like that.
Maybe, but we were talking earlier tonight about people we know who are just a little bit older than us who have that old school European mentality of the husband is in control and the wife is lesser.
That's not a position of respect.
No.
That's not respecting.
But it's also 2015 and this is set in the teens.
Yes. So it's a less offensive thing to do to your wife is what she would expect her husband to do.
I guess we've talked a lot about the cast before in the previous movie and we're talking about it plenty now. So Pacino we've covered, Cazal we've covered, Keaton, Shire, they're all in the previous movie. James Caan and this effective little cameo at the end. De Niro, though, his first AFI film, he's got 5 in total, not quite the record. His co-star, although he doesn't share any scenes with him in this movie, Robert Duvall, is in 6, and then Ward Bond's in 7, but all small performances. Yeah. But De Niro, unlike Duvall, and you point out in the Godfather podcast that Duvall, despite being in 6 movies, is a supporting player in all of them. De Niro is a lead in almost all of them, except for this one. Mm-hmm. And even in this, he's kind of a co-lead. He's done 3 movies with Pacino, as people probably know. He's in this movie, they never share any scenes together. Then he was in Heat, at one famous scene. And then the one time they actually act together in Righteous Kill, nobody liked the movie. But De Niro's going to be in Taxi Driver for us pretty soon. The Deer Hunter, Raging Bull, Goodfellas. Great titles where he is a big part of all those movies. He actually auditioned to be Sonny in the first film. And there are clips of him doing that on the DVD and Blu-ray. It's the making ofs.
I like his performance, but I have never been a member of the cult of De Niro. People love him so much.
He's tainted his own legacy with a lot of his recent performances, as has Pacino. Unfortunately, they've done maybe too many mediocre movies.
Maybe watching all of his classics now, as we're going to in the coming months, maybe I'll start to get it a little more. I've never watched them all concentrated like this before, so maybe I'll finally come around and understand what the big deal is. And I'm not criticizing his performance in this at all. But if I had to choose between him and Cazal,
no contest.
I would say Cazal had a better performance. Had a much more difficult performance. Mm-hmm. Him as Vito, it didn't really seem like it's that hard. It's kind of straightforward.
He doesn't really show that much range in that role either.
Yeah.
He's also got to ape a previous performance. He's got to sound like him and do the best he can to look like Vito as well.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot easier to praise him for Taxi Driver and Raging Bull movies.
Taxi Driver and Raging Bull are great, especially Taxi Driver, actually. Maybe the better of those two performances.
Mm.
Other smaller roles in the film, Bruno Kirby is the young Clemenza. Mm-hmm. We covered him in the Not 100 Project with When Harry Met Sally quite a while ago. And of course, he's in City Slickers, those two movies with Billy Crystal. And then Richard Bright as Al Neary, who has more dialogue in one speech than he does in the rest of the entire series, I think. And yet he's in all three movies as Pacino's bodyguard. He isn't really in the first movie until towards the end, of course. I think I asked you in the previous podcast who is the one who kills the biggest mob boss, Barzini, and it is him, posing as a cop. And there are other small players in this movie. I mean, the cast is enormous. I'm not going to go on too much more. But three guys. Frank Silvero, I knew I recognized that face. He is Frankie Carbone from Goodfellas. And he's the guy that goes to play with Vito when they first see Finucci.
Yeah, yeah.
Danny Aiello has a very small role as the guy who tries to kill somebody. We're going to see him and do the right thing.
Blink and you miss him in this movie. Mm-hmm. He's the guy who makes the assassination attempt on
Pantangeli.
Pantangeli. I can never say his name.
And then what does his name, according to Tom Hagen, mean in English?
I don't know.
Frankie Five Angels. Pantangeli. And the other actor, Harry Dean Stanton, who has a more important small role. Harry Dean Stanton's been in so many movies and for so long now, but he is one of the FBI guys who's protecting Pantangeli when he's in the witness relocation program.
He's a great character actor.
All right, Francis Ford Coppola has been talked about so much in recent weeks. We did The Godfather and American Graffiti in the last little while, and Patton wasn't that long ago, which he wrote, and he's still going to do Apocalypse Now. So five AFI films in total for him, three of which he directed. I know something in this film about his protagonists. They often end up destroyed mentally, emotionally, not literally, or alone. Michael, Captain Willard in Apocalypse Now, Harry Call in The Conversation, the Gene Hackman character, Mina from Dracula, and for that matter, Dracula. All through those centuries of living as a vampire. He seems to take on these characters, and many directors actually do, take on people who are isolated, alone. No one understands me. That's the way artists often feel, I think.
He likes to make movies about people on the down, on the downhill slope of their life.
And who are all by themselves, literally or metaphorically.
Speaking of patterns, we talked about a lot of the things that this film has in common with Citizen Kane, but it kind of shares those things in common with Gone with the Wind, too. And I bring that up because those movies on the first list made up three of the top four films. This is something that obviously strikes a nerve with people, the corruption of power and the way that getting what you want, which is in many ways the American dream, will destroy a person. Ambition is ultimately toxic, is a theme that people really like to see.
And the first bit of dialogue in the first movie is, I believe in America.
Mm-hmm.
These movies are definitely about the American dream. And you mentioned Citizen Kane. Great comparisons. There are a lot of them, actually, between the first movie and this one, and Citizen Kane. So Mario Puzo co-wrote again with Coppola, as he did on all three films. And he also wrote Superman later on. Not a lot of other credits, but who needs more than that? The Godfather trilogy is really enough for anybody. There's a lot of spin-off novels and other things have been written about this. I think Puzo's been involved in quite a few of those. Albert S. Ruddy, who won the Oscar for Best Picture as a producer of the first film, is not back on this one, but Francis Ford Coppola is a producer this time, along with Gary Fredrickson and a Coppola lackey. Well, not a lackey, he's an important player in the American zoetrope group, Fred Ruse, and they all went up there when they won the Oscar for Best Picture. Behind the scenes of this 185:1 print, gorgeous Blu-ray, much like the first film, Robert Harris restored these two movies. I don't know if he had to restore the third one, I forget if that's true or not. The honey-coated images, you said, sepia tone through a lot of it. And it does look different. If you look on DVD Talk, I believe, his website, where I was looking at a review and they showed images from the original release of the DVD versus the Blu-ray remastering, it looks a lot different. They've made it look sepia, no doubt about that. The cinematographer who helped restore that, Gordon Willis, who shot the two Godfather films, All the President's Men, Annie Hall, and only died in May of 2014. But he and Coppola did sign off on this new version, so they obviously liked the way that it was changed. Couple of editors on it, Barry Malkin, Richard Marks, who often worked with James L. Brooks, and Peter Zinner, who worked on the first movie and on The Deer Hunter. Three pretty legendary titles from the 70s and all won Best Picture. John Cazale, he looked at his face an awful lot in the 70s. Cazale was in all three of those. The musicians, Nino Rota, back after doing the first film, the Fellini veteran that he was, and Carmine Coppola shared the Oscar with Nino Rota. He did do the entire Godfather series in one way or another at composing, arranging, I don't really know much about music, but he was involved in the music and Apocalypse Now as well. And Dean Tavalaris, who is also a Coppola compatriot for many years, did the Godfather series, Bonnie and Clyde, and Apocalypse Now as the set guru. And Apocalypse Now has some incredible sets. I mean, this movie does too, and the first movie does for sure, but Apocalypse Now sets are great. And Walter Murch, the sound guy, was involved in the sound yet again. He was involved in most Coppola movies, I think, at this point.
And we'll be talking about him again during Apocalypse Now.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Both sound and editing. Okay, The Influence. First of all, it's the most respected sequel ever made, I would say. I said that last week leading into this podcast. Empire Strikes Back, Aliens, and the Lord of the Rings series are in the conversation, but there really aren't a lot of other movies that can honestly be thought of on this level. It's the only Best Picture winner that's a sequel other than Lord of the Rings Return of the King ever.
To say that other sequels aren't on this level is to leave out the fact that no films, period, very few films, period, are on the level of The Godfather.
I usually would save this question for you at the end, or I guess at the very beginning, but I'm asking you right now, 32nd on both lists, before you answered this question, actually, there were three movies that did not move from either list. We've talked about it before.
Yeah.
And we've talked about two of them in this podcast. One of them is Citizen Kane, Godfather Part 2. What's the third? Do you remember?
No.
The Best Years of Our Lives was 37th on both lists. But okay, 32nd didn't move. Goodfellas, we talked about already, didn't move up. Pulp Fiction barely moved up. Three crime classics that I thought when this list was redone in 2007 would zoom up, and they didn't.
But it's their way of saying, no, we thought we were right the first time. We thought we nailed it. This is the 32nd film.
So Godfather being third, then second, this movie not moving up at all. Where would you place it?
It is so hard. It's like saying, what do you like better, spaghetti or bolognese sauce? You can't you can't take them apart. They're almost as if they're two
Maybe
parts
they should
of
be
the
back-to-back
same film.
Or something. Yeah.
In the way that Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship of the Ring kind of represents all three movies, and Star Wars probably represents all three movies. And I understand why they didn't do that, because this is such a standalone, amazing film. But it's difficult to say where it belongs. Godfather is a great film, but does it deserve to take up two spots when these two films are...
part of the same story.
Yeah, but at the same time, when you say that, if you want to represent the whole trilogy, well, the third one kind of takes it down a notch,
which
it doesn't deserve either.
I mentioned the Sight and Sound poll. They've allowed movies to be combined. The Apu trilogy, Indian filmmaker made that. The Decalogue that Kieslowski, I think is his name, made. And the Godfather films can all be combined. So that would obviously make them zoom way up on their list, because if you're not going to have to pick between the first and second Godfather films, and you love them both, if you're sitting in the mat, you're going to say, well, I guess that's my choice for number one on the Sight and Sound poll. Okay, back to Influence. The Sopranos. We talked about that in the first podcast, obviously. More so the first film. But the whole series, including the third movie, did. The corruption of power, the murders, the sex, all kinds of R-rated things in that TV show. In this movie, despite the violence, there was not that much bloodshed, come to think of it. And I don't think we see any naked breasts like we did in the first film. And there's no swearing, as I recall.
Yeah.
So they actually scale back an awful lot of things. But there is a word that's in this movie that was not in the first movie. It's during the Senate hearings.
Mafia.
And it is mafia. And Casa Nostra, which apparently means our thing in Italian. Those phrases and words are never once used in the first film. Mm-hmm. Couple other influences. Breaking Bad. We've talked about it so much in this podcast because it's a great TV show. The comparison would be where Gus avenges a long-ago murder by murdering his rival.
And the comparison could be that a man who says he's doing everything for his family...
is not.
...ends up getting consumed by power and destroying his family.
Right. But I'm talking specifically about where Gus goes back to Mexico...
Oh, yeah. The Vendetta.
...to whack Stephen Bauer's character, who's in Scarface. Look at all these connections we're able to make here. And the last one I want to bring up is A Few Good Men, which may seem like a strange comparison. It's a small one, but there's a courtroom bluff in both movies. In A Few Good Men, Tom Cruise brings in two airmen to bluff Nicholson into saying that that flight didn't land, but they actually have no information whatsoever to make that true.
The way they bluff Pentangeli with his brother.
Mm-hmm. Who says nothing whatsoever.
Now he doesn't
just shows
have to.
Up and that's enough.
He just has to show up and look very, very baffled about everything that's going on around him. He says this guy's a successful businessman in his home country, but he does just have this air of naivete about what's happening. A little overkill.
According to Frank, he could have had his own family in America, but the guy speaks no English, so how could he have done anything in America and succeed? Okay, the awards and list section is quite a bit. Six Oscar wins. Best Picture, Best Director for Francis Ford Coppola, Supporting Actor for De Niro, the screenplay by Coppola and Puzo, the sets by Tavalaris, and the music by Rota and Carmine Coppola. So Francis was a three-time winner on this one movie. There were five other nominations that didn't succeed, most of them acting. Pacino, how did he not win? Two Supporting Actor for Michael Vigazzo and Lee Strasberg. Talia Shire for Supporting Actress, which I'm a little bit puzzled by, but okay. And the costumes. The movie made the National Film Registry in 1993. Took 4 years for them to say, let's put it in there. And then here are the AFI representations. Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer was 58th on the top 100 quotes list. Michael was 11th on the dark side of the heroes and villains list. And as we talked about in the previous movie, Vito was nominated for the villains list and didn't make it. And as I said then, in their world, he's not really truly a villain. But even in the mobster world, Michael is a villain and just missed making the top 10. Godfather Part 2 was 3rd in the gangster category in the top 100 genres. And was nominated for quite a few lists that didn't make. A couple of them are quotes. I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart. You broke my heart. And then kisses him. Was nominated for the quotes, as was Hyman Ross' line, "We're bigger than U.S. Steel." And the final nomination was for the top 100 genres in the epic category.
Ah, kind of appropriate.
And the first movie made the Thrills list. I think it was something like 15th or 18th or 11th or whatever it was. This movie wasn't even nominated for the Thrills list. And I guess there aren't enough thrills anyway in it. Only two movies from 1974, but extraordinarily strong movies that people still love to this day. Chinatown and Godfather Part 2. Which one do you prefer?
I'm saying it. Chinatown.
Yeah, I think so too. You had to save 50 Blu-rays or something from your shelf or DVDs, and I had to choose between those two only for some reason. There were 51 and then 50. I guess I have to go with Chinatown.
It's a personal preference. I'm not saying it's a better movie, but it's really hard to say which one of these is the better movie. Anyway, they're both total
masterpieces. What if you combined one and two?
If you combine one and two, God, then you're asking me to spend more than 6 hours watching film, and then it's a no contest.
You said during the first podcast you prefer Chinatown to that movie.
Yeah. So to well, both it's, of them I think for... I prefer watching Chinatown to the Godfather series. I guess that's as good as saying I prefer it, and I said the same about Goodfellas. They're just movies that I would rather sit down and watch, but at the same time, as a film fan, how can you not have reverential respect for every frame
what
of the Godfather
your
films?
Name is Grant? Or Peter Griffin. Peter Griffin. It insists upon itself.
You know, you have to give Grant credit. He had valid reasons for disliking these films that I think even a big fan can admit. Sometimes they drag.
And take forever to make their point, according to him. If you want to read his full comments on the first movie, then go to www.top100project.com if you're not there already, and look at the Godfather page, and his comments will be at the bottom of that page. All right, so definite thumbs up. Had it been a top 10 film, it wouldn't have surprised me. And I guess it wouldn't have surprised you either.
No, no.
Okay, so up next on the Top 100 Project is Robert Altman's bittersweet take on a musical, Nashville. One of the last movies you've not seen that we still have to cover.
You have been bigging this up for years. This better live up to the hype.
What about the Blu-ray? I think 2 years ago we've been saving it for all this time. All right, the coming attraction trivia for Nashville. How many Robert Altman movies were nominated for AFI's Top 100?
That's a good question.
You know two of them.
Yep. All right, for the answer to that question, please tune into next week's podcast. You can also find more trivia from Ryan and me, along with all kinds of other fun stuff, including links to some of the things that we talked about in today's podcast, on our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and remember to enter our contest to pick the movie for our first crowdsourced episode. All you have to do is write a review on iTunes, and your name will be submitted into a draw. And while you're there, subscribe. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. If you'd like to reach us directly, let us know what you think in a less public way. What do you think of the Godfather series? Where do you think it belongs on the list? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Please send us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
I know it was you, Bevo. You didn't break my heart. You didn't break my heart.